Good evening. See everybody this evening. Matt Red, we have the second copy of the Ten Commandments under consideration. Matt answered the last question. The first question is, to whom were the Ten Commandments given, and what do these verses indicate about the applicability of the Ten Commandments to Christians? Wes, would you like to address this question?
Sure. So, when it says that the Ten Commandments were given to you, we know, of course, that this generation did not live through the wilderness, the generation who literally were given those commandments at Horeb. They had all died except Moses, Joshua, and Caleb, and the covenant that God made lived on through their children and through their descendants. And so when it says it was given to you, it doesn't literally mean you, it means the people of Israel. And the implication for us today is that these things, not only in the Ten Commandments here, but throughout the scriptures, when Jesus is talking to individuals or when prophets are talking to individuals at the time, it doesn't only apply to those who were there who were literally hearing those words. It applies to us as believers.
Okay. Thank you. Who else would like to address to whom these were given and what applicability it means to us today? John.
Maybe I should have been more specific about the word applicability. I agree with what Wes is saying, though there are occasions in the Bible where something is spoken directly to an individual or to a limited group of people that was only meant for those people. Jesus gave some instructions to the apostles, for example, that were only meant for the apostles and not necessarily meant to apply in a strict way to all Christians. But concerning the Ten Commandments, Moses, I agree, is addressing all of Israel. It says that in verse 1, Hear, O Israel. But he says something in verse 3 that is quite interesting. He says, The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb, and I think the us is the people of Israel. And then in verse 3, he says, The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers. Now, fathers here has been interpreted in at least two ways. Some say that the fathers were the original generation who were there to receive the commandments. I don't understand how anyone can interpret it that way, because the covenant was made with that group of people. Those were the people to whom the covenant was given. The sacrifice was made in their presence. They were the ones who pledged their allegiance to the covenant, who were taken up, the elders taken up, to see the feet of God and to dine in the covenant ceremony. So it can't be them, it must be someone else. And generally in the book of Deuteronomy, and I have a list here of about 8 verses where this is true, chapter 1, verse 8, chapter 4, verse 31, verse 37, chapter 7, verse 8, and others, fathers means the patriarchs. And so the point is that God made this covenant with the nation of Israel, not with the patriarchs. We sometimes look at the Ten Commandments as a general list of rules that are applicable for all people in all ages, and that's certainly true of probably 9 of them, save the observance of the Sabbath, because those 9 are repeated in several codes throughout the Bible, including the New Testament. But the Ten Commandments, or the 10 words, as a summation of the law of Moses, was only given to the nation of Israel. And so in the strictest sense, the Ten Commandments, just like all of the other law code given to Israel, is not applicable to Christians. That is, Christians are not bound or compelled to keep those. Only those things which are revealed in the New Testament are bound in the most strict sense upon Christians. Now, one other thing about verses 4 and 5. Verse 4, at first seems like it contradicts the Exodus record when it says the Lord talked with you face to face. We remember that certainly was not the case. In fact, they were so afraid of what was happening, they wouldn't go close to the mountain. But verse 5 clarifies that Moses stood as the mediator. And so because Moses was such an extraordinary mediator, it's as if the Lord were talking to them face to face. God was able to fully transmit his will through Moses directly to the people. And so Moses became, in a magnificent way, the mouthpiece of God.
Thank you. Yeah, one of the verses you just listed was from last week, 4:37. Because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose their descendants after them, and he brought you out of Egypt with his presence, with his mighty power. So there, you know, that points back to the fathers being the patriarchs of old and establishing the precedent of being able to change covenants over time. You know, we look to a lot of times in communion, we read Luke 22:20. Likewise, he also took the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you." So that we have the ability to have change of covenants over time. Who else would like to address this question? All right. Going to question two. This covers verse 6 only. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." And Shahe, would you like to answer question number 2?
Sure. The question says, what brief introduction is given to the commandments, and what's the significance of the Ten Commandments for Israel? So the Decalogue, the word Decalogue, by the way, means 10 words. And generally speaking, the Bible doesn't really use the terminology 10 commandments. It does use the terminology 10 words. I don't think there's anything wrong with 10 commandments, but that's what the word Decalogue means. You read a lot of scholars who refer to these in that way. And it begins in verse 6, as you read, with a brief introduction referencing the Exodus and the delivery and redemption God worked during that time period. And this is a refrain used throughout the Old Testament. God continually reminds the people, even hundreds of years after this historical event, of what he did when he first brought them out of the land and made them his own special people. And so you might say that this, I don't know if this is the best terminology to use, but this is the crucifixion of the Old Testament. This is the scene where God redeemed his people, and then Bible writers look back on this scene as the most, or one of the most, if maybe the most, important event in Israel's history. And so this is their period of redemption. So he starts by saying, "You're mine, I redeemed you, and now you're going to listen to what I have to say," is sort of the way that these words are introduced. There's much to say about the nature of the Ten Commandments, but I just want to say one thing about the nature of law. I've preached before and presented the idea that in the Old Testament and the New Testament also, there are two kinds of law. There's one kind called apodictic law. That's what we have here in front of us. You shalt and you shalt nots. There's no leeway for violating these words, these commandments. God doesn't give any sacrifice or any case law that would allow someone to violate this and then make up for it later. They're just stated as absolute truths that must be held forth and complied with for all time. Apodictic law is contrasted with casuistic law, which is case law. That's sort of the if-then. If you steal from your neighbor, then you have to repay what you stole fivefold. So that's a common type of law in the Old Testament. But this type of law here, apodictic law, is really unique to this ancient time period. Scholars have looked over other law codes from this ancient time period in this part of the world, and most law codes from this time were case law, not any kind of absolute law like the 10 words, the 10 commandments are. So it makes the ten commandments pretty unique in this ancient time period, that God is stating absolute moral laws that must be held no matter what.
I also would like to address this kind of preamble to the Ten Commandments. Mark?
I like the expression in verse 6 there, that brought you out of the house of bondage. That is a striking idea to me. And obviously the most literal application is out of the furnace of Egypt, out of physically being slaves. But I think there's also an aspect of this out of the slavery to sin, because there's no question that the Israelites had issues with being sinners and, you know, engaging in idolatry and so on. And it made me think about Jesus' words in John 8:32, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And then the Jews answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants, and we have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" And Jesus says, "Whoever commits sin is a slave of sin." And then he uses this idea of the house. A slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. So it's interesting that Israelites were taken out of the house of bondage, and in the new covenant, we have been made sons, and we are allowed to dwell in the Father's house.
Kind of connects with Shaw Hayes. This is the crucifixion event of the Old Testament. Kind of the same thing Shaw Hayes is saying. Keel and Blitz commented that bringing them out of Egypt, Jehovah proved that he was their God by his strong arm. And then Israel also owed their existence as an independent nation to this act. And one thing I found interesting, not necessarily related to the question, but in Wikipedia, if you look up the Ten Commandments, it gives a kind of a matrix of all the different beliefs of the Ten Commandments. If I read this right, the Jews consider this the first commandment. You know, it's a statement, but they consider it the first commandment, and then they take verses 7 and 8. What we consider the second and the third, or the first and the second commandment, they wrap those together into the second commandment. Anybody else? Bill?
Yeah, I read one writer I read from talking about verse 6. He made the comment that the Lord had the right to tell Israel what to do, and Israel had an obligation to obey.
Anybody else before we move on to question number 3? Question number 3, and I'll read this question. How do these first 4 commandments pertain to Israel's relationship with God? What differences exist in this list of verses, in this list versus the initial one given in Exodus 20, verses 7, this covers verses 7 to 15, so this would be the first 4 commandments. Bill, would you like to answer this question?
Well, I mean, These first 4 commandments pertain to, I mean, just like the sentence says, they're about Israel's relationship to God. You know, commandment number 1, you know, no gods, no other gods but me. Commandment number 2, not only no gods but me, I don't want any images. I don't want you know, creating any images that you think might enhance your ability to worship me. You know, I'm your God, no other images. I found it interesting. Adam Clark pointed out, he was talking about the Jews and using verse 6 as the first commandment, combining what we would think of as the second, third, or first and second commandments into one. Adam Clark pointed out that the Catholic Church deleted the second commandment and divided the 10th commandment into 2 commandments, which I thought was pretty impressive. I mean, look at verse 12. I mean, why stop at just dividing it in half? You know, you could make a whole bunch of commandments out of that if you'd like. So anyway, I thought that was a little bit entertaining. John 4 and verse 24, God's a spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. The use of images and material things as a focal point or something to help focus, it denies God's command to worship in spirit. I like that. I might not have said it very well, but I like the thought there. The third commandment, taking the Lord's name in vain. You know, profanity is blasphemy and cursing and we hear it on TV all the time. This the frivolously throwing around the name of the Lord, and people I run into, they talk that way all the time. And I've asked a couple people about it, and they try to tell me how they're showing honor to God by doing that. And so it's hypocritically. I mean, claiming God's name on something and not living that way. That's another aspect of the third commandment and the fourth, as Shahe mentioned, remembering the Sabbath and keeping it holy. All four of these are about Israel and their relationship to the Lord. So then the second part of the question, what differences exist in this list versus the initial one given in Exodus chapter 20, verse 15. Verse 15 is missing in the Exodus account entirely.
You know, there's a different description in the Exodus account as there is in the Deuteronomy account, verses 11 of chapter 20 of Exodus and verses 15. So, you know, in Exodus we have the fact that God created the earth and he rested, and that's given as an example. Versus here, there's a reminder of them being slaves in Egypt, and they're about to come in this land, and what God's given them, and that they should, you know, rest, as he's shown them. Taylor?
To go back to the first four commandments, like the common thread, I try to think of a phrase or sentence to sort of summarize it, and I thought of keeping God holy, keeping his things holy, and so keeping his superiority at the top, keeping his name holy, not sullying his name by trying to make a graven image of him. And then the Sabbath is sort of oddball to that a little bit, but keeping his ordinances holy, the things that he's given. This idea with verse 14 and 15 in Exodus 20 is interesting, because as you mentioned, here it's given as for a rest, and then there for a memorial. So Jameson, Foss, and Brown speculated, I thought this was interesting, I don't know how accurate, but they speculated that the mention of rest here is because the Hebrews at this time have slaves, they have servants that they've taken, and there might have been a pattern of denying some of these people their rights as Jews to rest on the Sabbath, because as is mentioned, Israel wasn't able to in Egypt, and so perhaps there's this idea, or this abuse even, of this ordinance, and then that fits very well with verse 15. This idea of why in verse 14 is it stressing the servant, because in verse 15, remember that you were there once, remember what it's like, and so don't oppress or don't make keeping the law a difficult thing for those who are already in bondage to you. And if I thought it was interesting as well, it seems that some Jews took the no graven images to mean no art, or at least very limited art. And from history, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of ancient Jewish art that survives, at least as compared to other cultures. So that was an interesting note. And as some trivia, there are three sculptors mentioned in the Bible. And when this looking at Jewish art, there's Moses, when he makes the bronze serpent, there's Aaron, when he sculpts the golden calf, and then Belzatel, the guy that sculpts the cherubim for the ark. So there are three artists, at least, mentioned in the Bible, but it doesn't seem art was popular in the ancient Hebrews.
Shahe?
So one of those three built an idol, the other one built something that became an idol, and then of course, the other was guided by the Holy Spirit in constructing the furniture for the tabernacle. So the difference here, all this shows us is that the Sabbath was meant to reflect different purposes. Not only does it reflect God's work in creation and resting on the seventh day, it also reflects the deliverance in Egypt. And then in later writings, like Isaiah, talks extensively about the purpose of the Sabbath as being a day of worship. So the Sabbath day, as the holy day, the sign of the Mosaic Covenant, Exodus 31 tells us that, the sign of the Mosaic Covenant was meant to reflect a number of holy sacred themes. And one is stated in Exodus, another is stated here in Deuteronomy. What I wanted to talk about, though, is the first commandment. Because the first commandment, which says, "You shall have no other gods before me," is strange and unique, again, for ancient systems of religion. Because in polytheism, there was no sense of having one god above another. There were a plurality of deities, which were sometimes at various levels, but generally seen as part of a pantheon. And they worked in cooperation with one another. And so there was no sense in the ancient world, the ancient polytheistic world, of elevating one god above another to being the supreme, or to having only one god, one deity. And so the first commandment
where it says, you shall have no other God before me probably means at the side of me. There's no other God like me, other passages say. And so that, I think, is quite interesting, and appreciate everything else that's been said from Bill about the other commandments, especially taking the Lord's name in vain.
Okay, question number four is, how do the last six commandments pertain to Israel's relationship with one another, and what differences exist in this list of verses? What differences exist in this list versus the initial one given in Exodus 20? And this covers verses 16 to 22. Trace, would you like to answer this question?
Sure. The commandments are honor your father and your mother, and you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, and you shall not covet what your neighbor has, basically. And they, as the question says, they pertain to how they shouldn't sin against one another. So this one, kind of in a way, you know, we're made in God's image, so we're supposed to respect each other. And by violating any of these laws, we violate God, because when we violate each other, we violate what God's put before us. One of the differences I saw, there weren't any really huge differences that stood out to me. They're pretty similar. But let's see. In Deuteronomy 5:21, it says, shall not desire your neighbor's house. And compared to Exodus 20, verse 17, it says, shall not covet your neighbor's house. So desire and covet are similar. And of course, the way in Exodus is kind of looking forward to this time when they're re-receiving the Ten Commandments, and this other one is looking back at a way, you know, to how they received the Ten Commandments before they roamed in the wilderness for 40 years. And I have a good verse over here, Romans 13:9. It says, for the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet, and if there is any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbors as yourself.
Good. Thanks. Taylor?
Kind of go off what Trace just referenced. I think it's interesting that Leviticus 19 repeats the majority of the Ten Commandments, or at least some of the principles behind them. And then Jesus references Leviticus 19 and Matthew 22:36-40 when he's asked about the greatest commandment and the second. And then I thought that was an interesting way to look at the past two questions. The greatest commandment being love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, so the first four. And then loving your neighbor as yourself, encompassing the last six. I thought that was an interesting way to look at those groups of commandments. Oh, and then the first, at least among these last six, the first few are sins of deed, of action, and then the last few are sins of word, and ultimately sins of the heart.
Thank you. Wes?
Related to Taylor's comment about the first four commandments with this emphasis on the slaves and how there might have been a change in the household arrangements. Now we see that the field is added, and they shouldn't covet the field. We saw at the end of Numbers that the land was divided up, people had land, they had property now, and so it makes sense to add that to the list of things on covet.
They're about to have fields that they could covet where they couldn't before. So, hey.
And the prohibition against covetousness is unique in the list because it has to do with an inner disposition. It has to do with an attitude more than an action. As Taylor pointed out, these sins predominantly in the second part of the list are all reflected in an action. Stealing or adultery or murder or even perjury is something that is an action, whereas covetousness is something that is an inner disposition. And so, of course, God knows, as Jesus says, that sin proceeds from the heart. That's where it starts. And so if you covet a person's life, you are prone to perhaps murder them. If you covet someone's wife, adultery may ensue. If you covet someone's property, then stealing could be problematic for you. And so the Lord here starts with the heart, where these problems emanate, and tries to nip them in the bud. In fact, many scholars have pointed out that if Israel would just keep the 10th commandment, none of the previous ones should have been a problem for them, at least in this second half of the list. And one thing that's interesting is the prohibition against covetousness, at least as I understand it, in the old law, did not have any type of mechanism for punishment by the nation, like many of the other sins that are listed in this 10 commandments. If you murder, you were executed for that. That was a capital offense, as well as some of the others on this list. Stealing was a capital offense, but you had to go to court and you had to make all that right with restitution. Where covetousness, I don't think, has any judicial code applied to it in the Old Testament, but it does in the New. In 1 Corinthians 5, when Paul is giving a list of the kinds of sins for which Christians should withdraw fellowship, in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 11, he includes covetousness. Christians who are covetous should be withdrawn from by the church. So that's a difficult challenge, of course, discerning when a person has committed that sin and to such a degree that they require church discipline. But I thought that was interesting here, that even though God absolutely prohibits covetousness, knowing that from the heart sin flows, there's no community censure attached to it in the old law like there is in the new.
It would be very hard for the community to know unless, I mean, they could act on those things or they could say something, I suppose. It would be the only Wes?
This idea Shai brought up about the covetousness being an internal sin versus a behavior is interesting. It's something that I've looked at in studying through James. And James talks a lot about that your faith is seen through your works. Other people can't observe your faith directly, right? But this also, in addition to covetousness leading to these other sins, there's a shift from the Old Testament to the New, where Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount that if you hate your brother, you've committed murder in your heart. He says, verse 21 of Matthew 5, you've heard it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. Whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. In 1 John, it goes even further. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer, it says. And so there is this difference. In the Old Testament, they might have looked at that and said, well, I didn't actually physically murder someone. But Jesus, in here in 1 John, it's saying just the feelings and the internal desire to sin is equal to actually sinning.
Thank you. Taylor mentioned, I think it was Matthew, but we also have a similar, you know, this, we've talked about kind of the division of these verses. In Mark 12:28, Jesus says this. It says this. Then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, which is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered and said, the first of all commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. This is the first commandment. And the second like it is this, You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. If you kind of research Ten Commandments, there's ways, different ways, different groups, again, divide the Ten Commandments based on this. It was kind of interesting that the Jews included the fifth commandment in with the part of the first four. So the first five to them was about loving God, and the second five is about loving your neighbor. And then to Bill's point, there are different groups divide different ways. There is and have. Kind of important to realize that when we're talking to different people that what we consider the Ten Commandments from the Bible is not necessarily what they consider. This is an example of what the Catholics use as the Ten Commandments, or they basically omitted the second one and split number 10 into two, and there you have 10. And there are other ones. Like I say, if you go to Wikipedia, there's kind of interesting matrix of what people believe. Let's move on to question number 5. And question number 5 covers verses 23 to 27. It says, why were the people afraid of God, and what did they ask Moses to do for them? Lance, would you like to answer this question?
Sure. Well, this whole scene was pretty awesome. I'm sure it was to behold. And the Lord spoke. There was fire, a cloud, thick darkness, a loud voice, and it all made such an impression on the people of Israel that they were afraid that they would die. They were afraid that the strict fire of the Lord would consume them and they would die. They also asked Moses to petition the Lord to not speak to them directly anymore. I found a pretty neat contrast online. Someone had a kind of just a, I guess an article on Deuteronomy 5. And he kind of made a point that I didn't necessarily read it this way at first, but kind of the message he was sending to the Israelites was, come unto me, but fear me, sort of message, almost stay away from me, sort of thing. And this guy kind of made a contrast to us today, fearing God, but also drawing near to him. And in contrast, we also see this in Hebrews 12, verses 8 through 24, that we're under the new covenant. And we're coming to Mount Zion as opposed to Mount Sinai, and God's message is, come unto me. So that was
it. Yeah, you mentioned Hebrews, and the people, you know, they were scared of God's voice. In Hebrews 12:25, says, see that you do not refuse him who speaks, for if they do not escape who refused him who spoke on earth, how much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven? That, referring back to Jesus. And also, as Lance mentioned, you know, in Exodus, we get, here we're talked, it talks about the voice, but in Exodus it also mentions the environmental conditions that amplified their fear of God's voice, the darkness, the mountain burned with fire, thunder, lightning, smoke, and this trumpet sound, so it would have been a fearful thing to be there. Bill?
Yeah, I kind of got on to verse 27, where, you know, you go near and here's Israel telling Moses, you go near and hear all that the Lord our God may say, and tell us all that the Lord our God says to you, and we will hear and do it. So they're making a pretty bold statement here that it's going to be hard for them to hold.
Another thing that, remember back to the last chapter, in chapter 4 and verse 12 and verse 15, it talked about the Lord spoke and there was no image. And so here again is this idea of no graven image. You can't hold a, you know, physical concept of God in your mind. So, and that probably made the voice even more fearful. Anybody else before we move on to the last? Question number 6. How did the Lord respond to the fear of the people? This covers the last verses 28 to 33. Dennis?
Well, he voiced his desire that they, the Israelite people, would indeed obey him, that it would be well with them and the children. Comes across with a yearning from God that his people would love him enough to obey him so that they could have long, good lives and that he desires for them. Very much like a parent, you know, with a child wanting what's best for them, and then them recognizing great value in loving and obeying their parents' counsel.
Yeah, he was glad they feared him. To your point, it was, you know, like a parent and a child was glad that they respected him at this time. Anybody else? Taylor?
I think verse 29 is really powerful. Just that idea, number one, that God would say that about Israel, but especially knowing what we know, looking back at history, that God knew what was coming. And as Dennis said, it's almost as a parent looking at a horrible series of events that are going to take place and saying, oh, you know, if you would just stay faithful and keep your part of the covenant, then things would be well with you. But And it evokes, or Jesus evokes, I think, that same sentiment in Matthew 23:37, the idea of wanting to gather Jerusalem together, but you would not allow it. And that same idea there of seeing what's in the future and the terrible things that are going to come to pass because of disobedience to God, not really being able to do anything about it other than to exhort the people to stay faithful. And I think it's interesting in Jeremiah 32:40, God makes a promise there to the people, of course, after a lot of rebellion, but that if they would keep that heart, they would return to that heart and seek it, that God would give it to them. And there, Jeremiah 32:40, God said, I will make an everlasting covenant with them, that I will not turn away from doing them good, but I will put my fear in their hearts, that they will not depart from me. And so that was always there on God's end. Unfortunately, Israel so many times failed to keep their good covenant.
John?
Something else in verse 29 says, oh, this is the Lord speaking to Moses. Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments. They were already terrified. They had fearful anxiety. So God's looking for something else here. He's not looking for anxiety. He's looking for reverential fear, the type of fear that would inspire them and motivate them and prompt them towards obedience. And the way he words that, always keep all my commandments, makes me think of the list that you had up there of the Catholic version of the Ten Commandments. So several years ago, I was in, Liz and I had gone down to a lecture at a religious school, and afterwards they walked us out of the auditorium through their gift shop. And so as I was walking through the gift shop, I saw this wall that was covered in religious relics. And it had all kinds of little statues of Jesus from infancy to the crucifixion, things that you would buy and put on your dresser at home or somewhere else around the house. And all the way at the very end, I saw several placards of the Ten Commandments. And that was the first time I was ever exposed to this version of the Ten Commandments, and I laughed out loud. Because the commandment they omit is the prohibition against making graven images of the Lord. That's the prohibition. That's the prohibition that's omitted in this version. And I just guffawed because I thought, well, you'd have to. You'd have to omit that if you were going to have any kind of justification in your own mind that this was okay. Of course, these are people who believe the Ten Commandments are still binding upon Christians in the here and now. And so God says to Moses, always keep all my commandments. If you want to get away with something, you're going to have to omit some of those commandments. And God will never allow that to be okay.
Lance?
Just got one small thing to add. This kind of seconds everything that everybody's already said, but I really liked also in verse 29, kind of the overall theme is it's God's love for us. Then we look back, we also see God's glory from the mountain. And, you know, the fear of God and the love of God are the two things that should really spur us along to do what's right always. And normally if we find ourselves lacking or, you know, having trouble obeying God, we're lacking in one or both of those areas.
Okay. Well, when we close, we usually like to offer the gospel invitation, but it's, we just talked about the voice that the people feared. And I thought, you know, it's kind of an interesting connection to Matthew 17:5, Mount Transfiguration, and God says from heaven, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him.